The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning to you. 4 minutes past nine, Monday the 2nd of October. Welcome to October 2023. How are you all keeping? How was your weekend? I hope it was a good one for you, and the week continues in the same vein. The lines are open for you to get involved in the programme. Comment on what we're talking about. Raise your own issues. You know what we do here. 086 60 25,000. WhatsApps and texts to that number. 086 60 25,000. Or give us a call on 07491 25,000. If you want to email, it's comments@highlandradio.com. And don't forget, of course, you can watch the show live on your big TV. If it's a smart TV, the app's on there for you, I'm sure. And also YouTube on your Fire Stick if you want to watch us there as well. And we're also across all your mobile devices on YouTube and Facebook. Right, let's get to look at what's making the front pages of the papers today. We'll start with the Derry People Donegal News. An advocacy group assisting those negatively impacted by care during the COVID-19 pandemic has said it's providing legal and grief support to families in Donegal. Care Champions, we had them on the show quite some time ago, and they were at the time progressing cases for people down the country. But as we were concluding that conversation with them, we did have an awful lot of calls from people who wanted to engage with that group. So not surprising to see that they are progressing some cases now, it seems, or at least representing and supporting some people here in Donegal. Care Champions told the Donegal News it's supporting families in the county who were negatively impacted by care during COVID. Supports included for family experienced grief, for those taking legal challenges, and some who have cases with the Ombudsman. It comes as up to 30 care homes could face criminal investigation depending on results of a Garda inquiry into the death of a woman in a residential home during the COVID-19 pandemic in 2021. The Derry News has some good advice on the front of its paper today. Get yourself checked. As Breast Cancer Awareness Month begins, popular local community worker Jeanette Wark is urging women to check their breasts regularly and note any changes. Jeanette, who is the project manager with the Cathedral Youth Club in the Fountain area of the city, made the call during the group's annual Macmillan Cancer Support Coffee Morning. And, you know, having spoken to hundreds of people at this stage over the years who have been diagnosed with cancer or another condition, is they know themselves. You know yourself if there's something not right. Now, obviously, that doesn't mean don't check, don't go to the doctor. But if you know there's something going on, it's really, really advisable to get it checked and to not miss those appointments either, the breast check appointments. They are really, really crucial, and they pick up so many cases of cancer early, which makes the outcomes and the treatments potentially easier on the person. So it is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. So as I say, check yourself, go to those appointments, and trust your gut. On to the Irish Independent now. And families in the squeezed middle stand to gain most in Budget 24 next week, with measures set to benefit commuters and parents. Party leaders are poised to halt the scheduled rise in excise duty on fuel due at the end of this month. The move will save hundreds of euro for long-distance drivers and even those with shorter runs, such as parents dropping children to school. As we know, the price of fuel back through the roof again, but it looks like the government might defer their latest excise. I was going to say increase, but I mean it is they are restoring it. Meanwhile, there'll be increased funding for the school's meal programme, extending the provision of hot food to hundreds of new facilities. The Irish Independent also understands there will also be a special new scheme to give full SUSE third level grants to single parents who want to study. It will focus on helping lone parents who want to go on to college, with Taoiseach Leo Varadkar and Higher Education Minister Simon Harris determined to end the requirements for a person to be in full-time education to avail of the grant. And Simon Harris will be on the programme with us a little later on in this hour, I believe, and we can perhaps get a comment from him in relation to that speculation. On to the Irish Times this morning, and up to 30,000 people on their third or subsequent learner permits have never sat a driving test, and in some cases may have been driving for almost 30 years without ever holding a full licence. This is a story that pops its head up every couple of years, and we've covered it on numerous occasions. You see, if you have a provisional license, you can renew it, but you have to do a test. Oh, but no, you don't. You simply have to have applied for a test to renew the license. So there are a cohort of people out there, maybe you know some of them, that just apply for a test and then renew the provisional license. I don't think all of them are driving. I think some people want it as a form of ID and perhaps don't have a car or don't get behind the wheel. But there's no doubt there are some that are perpetually extending their driving license and are out on the road on the provisional. Well, the figures emerged after the Road Safety Authority examined records of learner permit holders back to 1994 following inquiries from the Irish Times. The data shows tens of thousands of learner motorists on their third or subsequent permit since 2018 have been driving for many years without ever sitting a test. Learner permit holders on their first or second learner permit were excluded from the analysis, as these are considered a period when learner drivers are undergoing lessons. And maybe you're one of those that does renew your learner permit. Contact us in confidence, of course, and let us know what's the story. 086 60 25,000. It's getting kind of personal and nasty, some would say. The row between rank and file Gardaí and Drew Harris, the relationship untenable, though they are going to maintain it because Drew Harris is the full backing of Minister for Justice Helen McEntee, but rank and file Gardaí, not so much. 99% of them simply don't. Well, the minister has said she will not direct Gardaí on where and when they should work, as rank and file Gardaí prepared to engage in escalated industrial action in a roster dispute. Members of the Garda Representative Association have threatened to withdraw their label if the standoff with Commissioner Drew Harris over the re-implementation of pre-COVID roster system is not resolved. And I heard some unsavoury sort of commentary on that suggesting that the guards are taking this action or are voting because of some sort of sectarian motivation or because Drew Harris is from the north, which is nonsense. The GRA actually were quite welcoming of him in his arrival, in that it was I remember the interview at the time, it was like, well, you know, he's a fresh set of eyes and maybe he can fix some of the problems that are there and identifiable. I don't think there's any motivation other than the fact that these Gardaí believe that he's just the head of an organisation that's not doing its job correctly. That would be their view. I don't think it's rooted in anything to do with where he's from or his religion for that matter. But anyway, I do hear and see that narrative around over the weekend, which I think is a little unfair. But back to budget speculation. And if you are a smoker, you won't want to hear this. A single cigarette could cost €1 by 2025 if the government adopts pre-budget recommendations from a healthcare charity. The Irish Heart Foundation said it was proposing the price increase because smoking rates in the young are on the rise. So you would effectively be looking at €20 a box of cigarettes by 2025. Chris Macy, Director of Patient Support with the charity, said studies show hikes in tobacco tax are the most effective way to reduce smoking levels. After a 50-cent increase last year, the current cost of a packet of 20 cigarettes in the most popular price category is €15.80. Mr. Macy said the Irish Heart Foundation is calling for a commitment from government to increase the price of a packet of 20 cigarettes to €20 by 2025. This would require a budget increase of €2.10 for the next 2 years. I believe there is some significant money going on cigarettes this year. That being said, you know, there might be less cigarettes sold, but truthfully, are a lot of people out there not smoking counterfeit cigarettes? They're kind of easy to get a hold of. I mean, there are those that would be discouraged from starting smoking and maybe even some that might stop, but I think a lot of people, obviously, who are very addicted to a very addictive substance might find themselves on the black market, which in and of itself is it's dangerous because you don't know, well, you don't know what you're smoking anyway. But anyway, my point being is that a lot of people will continue to smoke. The state will lose the revenue and it'll be illegal cigarettes that they're smoking. The Irish Daily Mirror has a special investigation, as well as The Star. They have the same special investigation. The health service has a portfolio of vacant properties worth hundreds of millions of euro, the Irish Mirror can reveal. A special investigation has found it is sitting on more than 250 buildings lying idle across the country. The HSE has been labelled as the country's biggest land hoarder at a time when there is a crisis in housing. The properties it hold include the Manse in Manor Hamilton Leitrim, which sits on extensive grounds, and also listed as a vacant property although I'm not sure. Is it 100% accurate? Let me know. Is St. Connell's Hospital in Letterkenny. It's a huge sprawling building, obviously on a quite a large site, but it's listed as a vacant property. There is some activity there, but for the most part, is it vacant? That could be a good resource. But then again, here locally, people are calling for services to be there for as long as it's been lying somewhat vacant. And finally, Met Erin says they are willing to drop Kieran from a list of storm names after colleagues in another country queried how to pronounce it. What a load of nonsense. There's loads of different names with different pronunciations. Kieran is hardly greatly challenging, is he? The Met said they were happy with the choice of Fergus as an Irish name for the list, and Kieran was chosen as a bonus name. An email to foreign colleagues said it's pronounced Kier, but if you think it's too complicated to pronounce, it wouldn't be a problem for us to let it go. So hopefully they don't, the foreign weather forecasters don't veto you if you're a Kieran, because we'd love to have a storm named after you. It's so important. All right, that is a look at the papers. We'll be back with our first guest on the show. And don't forget, you can watch our next guest if you log on to our YouTube or Facebook channels. That's coming up after a break. We bid good morning now to Ger Deering, the Ombudsman. Good morning to you, Ger. Thanks so much for joining us on the show again.
Good morning, Greg. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you back on. Right, now your office busy. Hundreds of patients who were refused reimbursement of their treatment overseas, I presume this includes Northern Ireland, does it as well, by the HSC, are having their cases re-examined following criticism from your office. So just outline the work that's been done here, if you don't mind, Ger.
Thanks, Greg. Yes, I will do. This is a good news story, really, because in April we spoke to you about the report In Sickness and in Debt, where we had pointed out that there was maybe an over-bureaucratic approach to the implementation of three particular schemes, including, as you mentioned, a scheme involving Northern Ireland. We made 21 recommendations to the HSE, and I'm very pleased to say that the HSE is implementing those very much in the spirit with which we required. So what that has meant is that a number of people who were refused reimbursements for a variety of reasons have since got reimbursements. Now, the HSE is working through the various different categories of people. It's important, Greg, that I point out, though, that people have to have an entitlement in the first place. So it would only be people who were refused on certain grounds. For example, some people had a difficulty with the referral letter. So in a number of cases, we came across situations where maybe the GP himself or herself had not actually signed the referral letter, but the referral letter was genuine and everything else about it was correct. So the HSE has re-looked at those, and a number of people who were refused on that basis have since actually received their refunds. Another difficulty that people were experiencing was proof of payment. And in some respects, the HSE were looking for way too onerous proof of payment. I mean, as far as we were concerned, once the person had proved that they had the procedure and that they actually paid for the procedure, other things like travel, for example, and that would be particularly relevant to Northern Ireland because most people probably just got a lift from somebody or somebody kindly drove them to the hospital or the clinic. So they wouldn't necessarily have proof of travel as well as proof of payment, but it wasn't required. So I'm pleased to say that those areas have been re-looked at by the HSE and a number of people have received refunds.
Yeah, and one of the silly things that people had to do was go and buy something in a shop or something to prove they were there on a certain day, to the point where I saw someone on Facebook about a month ago saying, was anyone in Derry on the 12th of March that was in a shop and kept the receipt because that just so happened to be the time that they were there? These are probably kind of extreme examples, but it seems to happen relatively regularly. Does it mean things like that we're less likely to see that going forward, Ger?
Yes, that's absolutely my understanding. Not alone are these things being rectified for people who didn't get a refund because of them, but much more importantly, we see the scheme now as being administered in a much more reasonable manner. And I'm very pleased with that. Bernard Gloucester took a particular interest in this, the new CEO at the time of the HSE, and he put in place, in fact, there's really a new office. And also, very importantly, there's a new appeal process in place. We weren't happy with the appeal process that was there. So that has all improved. Another thing that is very helpful for people is there were some people who had what was called a first charge put on. So they had received treatment. Say, for example, somebody had their hip done, genuinely had the procedure done, applied in good faith to have a refund, and then found that there was an issue because maybe they had an income from another jurisdiction, like a pension, and that would often happen, as you can imagine, close to the border. Mm-hmm. And in those cases, people applied in good faith. Yes, there was an issue around the pension, but it wasn't pointed out in time. So after a long battle with our office, the HSE agreed to refund those. This is over the last number of years. But they then put in place what they described as a first charge. So that meant apparently that if you went to have another procedure done, the money would be clawed back through that. I'm glad to say that's all. None of that is happening anymore. So this scheme is now being administered in a really good manner, in my view. And I think people should have confidence to use it. And I think it's important to remind people that the schemes are there, because there are long waiting lists. And, you know, nobody goes abroad or into another jurisdiction to have treatment just for the sake of it. Everybody would rather have the treatment here at home.
And Jared, you know, the reason why this work is so important is because you would imagine with us being, you know, a border station, we'd speak to an awful lot of people like this, and they have had problems. But sometimes people have to go to the credit union for a loan or something. And then they hear the horror stories of only half the money being returned, or the HSE disputing something or other, and they're left with a short-term loan that they took out that they can't really afford to pay, and the interest mounting on that. So it was a barrier. There's lots of people listening for reasons such as that, because of the reputation of this scheme, that didn't, because they couldn't front-load the cost themselves, and they were afraid then of getting landed with a 3 or 4 year loan. So they were actually having to choose whether to be able to walk around, you know, or what. So I agree with you. If people have more faith in this, I think there will be a bigger uptake, because, as I've just outlined, people were nervous.
I think that's a very important point. Absolutely. People should have more confidence. That said, Greg, like any scheme, there are criteria. And it's important, for example, for people to know that you do need a referral letter. So I'd advise people to check out the scheme, to go onto the HSE website and check out the scheme before they engage. Another point to note is that you are entitled to a refund of what you paid, or the cost, what it would have cost to have the procedure done in the Republic. So again, there are genuine criteria there that the HSE must enforce, and we support that. So it's best that people would check out in advance. But as you rightly say, the vast majority of people who avail of these schemes either borrow from the credit union or maybe a family member. By virtue of the fact that they have to avail of these schemes, it is very likely that they don't actually have private health insurance. If they had private health insurance, they would probably have had the procedure done privately in the Republic. So it is a scheme that allows people to have, there are three schemes that allow people to have essential procedures done, but it is best to check out in advance what the criteria are.
And just in terms of, I mean, obviously you've made representations on behalf of a number of patients, but there are those maybe listening now that go, well, this applies to me and I didn't get my refund, or I ended up getting saddled with this. Is there any recourse for anyone listening in that situation? Is there a limit, time limit, if there is, as to when they might be able to claw something back from the HSE?
Well, I would suggest that anybody who believes that they were wrongly denied a payment under this scheme should contact the HSE in the first instance. It is open to them to come to us after that if they're unhappy with the decision. But again, I would just differentiate between maybe somebody who didn't get a referral letter and simply didn't qualify for a scheme, as opposed to somebody who had a referral letter for sure, that there was a wrong date or an issue with. So if they're in doubt, I would suggest that they should contact the scheme. And there is a new office there now dealing with all of these queries and dealing with the scheme. So I think it would be important for people to check out with the HSE whether there is any change in their eligibility, or whether there's something that can be looked at.
So in terms of the proof of travel and getting a purchase on the day of the operation or what have you, has that been waived? Like, in other words, what is the proof that's required now going forward that the HSE will need before they consider, well, before they reimburse the person?
Well, it's best to check in advance, but my understanding is what the HSE now requires is proof that you've paid, proof that the procedure actually took place, and proof that you've actually paid. It's very important to point out, Greg, that for 2 out of 3 of these schemes, your travel wasn't refunded anyway.
Yeah, so, I get you.
You weren't getting that money back in any event. So my understanding is now that where travel is not refunded, the HSE are not looking for proof of travel. They will accept that if you went to a particular hospital and had the treatment done and you have proof that you've paid that hospital, well, you obviously then travelled there to have it done. So
And just to reiterate, in fairness, because, you know, chief executives of big organisations often get a rough deal, but you are pleased with how Bernard Gloster has taken on board your concerns and seemingly acted upon them. So credit where credit is due there.
Absolutely. In fact, this report was ready before Bernard came into office, and I held it back to give him an opportunity. I felt it was only fair to a new CEO to have that opportunity. And I met him within the first 2 weeks, and he accepted that there were shortcomings in how the schemes had been implemented. And he fully accepted or agreed to implement the 21 recommendations. And what I want to pay tribute to is not just the fact that he agreed to do them, much more importantly, in a short number of months, very significant progress has actually been made on implementing those recommendations. So we try to work in cooperation and collaboration with public bodies. We're not out to persecute anybody. We simply want to see schemes and services operate the way they should. So it's even when things go wrong, it's very good to see that somebody's willing to rectify that and put things right.
That's our philosophy here as well. We're not interested in criticising people and organisations for the sake of it. It's all with a view to improving things for service users and the public. Gerard, thank you for your time as always. Have a lovely day.
Thanks very much, Greg.
Bye-bye. Paddy joins us on the programme now. Paddy, what was your experience, and good morning to you?
Good morning, Greg. My experience was all very good, Greg. Referral letter, proof of purchase. Don't really understand that one, but proof of purchase. But then I also had to produce bank statements showing the transaction made on my bank statement to the HSE as well, on top of everything else. So I had to print bank statements. I took a screenshot that wasn't suffice. I had to actually print the bank statements and send them off to them.
Wow. So they really wanted everything by your inside leg measurement there. They wouldn't, but hopefully... Hopefully that...
He hasn't mentioned that all the same, Greg. He didn't mention it there. Listen to your show. He didn't mention that part. He mentioned the proof of purchase, proof of travel.
Yes.
But he hasn't mentioned there, that guy was on there, hasn't mentioned the fact you have to print your bank statement.
Yeah.
And show how it
transaction. We'll double check with his office because, I mean, you would imagine, Paddy, that a receipt from the private hospital would cover all of that, wouldn't you? You know what I mean?
What's your card details? What's your card details on it that include the last three figures or four figures off your card?
Yeah.
Always goes XXX and then the last four figures off your card, which and any other place as proof of purchase and proof that you were there.
And you believe that this is busybodying by the HSE, a breach of your privacy?
No, it's a red tape scenario, Greg. Slow it down and then people might just get fed up. If it's €100 or €200 or whatever, you know, they might turn around and go, you know what?
Is it worth it? Yeah, okay. Well, hopefully, Paddy, these 21 recommendations, I'm going to go through them. Hopefully that's covered in it because that is an overreach and unnecessary. And as you say, there was a sense with this scheme that it was designed to discourage you with red tape. But Gerard Deering, he's the ombudsman. He feels that hopefully some of that red tape's been gotten away with now.
Well, as I say, you can check the recommendations there, Greg, but that was one of them. You had to print bank statements.
Yeah.
And show them your bank statement and highlight the transaction. Now, every other transaction you made in your bank statement was for their reading as well.
Right.
And
well,
including your account.
How long ago is it since you used the scheme, Paddy, if you don't mind me asking?
I was asked about maybe 5 to 6 weeks ago for my bank statements. They were dealing with it, but they contacted me about that the screenshot wasn't good enough. That I need to send bank statements just further, just yet again.
Yeah, busybodying. Okay. Right. Paddy, hopefully it went well for you, though, in any case, despite that, and you're feeling a bit better now. All right. Good.
No, that's okay. Great. Thank you.
Take care. Thanks, bye. Paddy. Martin, good morning to you.
How's it going, Greg?
I'm all right, Martin. Your family dealt with this scheme, but it didn't work out as you expected. Tell us what happened.
I'll tell you, Greg, my mother got her hip done in Derry, and she was supposed to get 11,000 back, you know.
Yep.
I think the operation was costing 14, but she went to the credit union, you know, to get it done. And when she got it done, she asked could she get home, or she didn't ask. She said that... They said if she could do the exercises, that she could get home that night.
Yeah.
and she got home, but she only got half the money back because she didn't stay the night.
Wow. You know. Yeah, that's definitely so one. You see, the Ombudsman's office is very useful. You know, that would definitely be one for you to check up on, Martin, or your family, because that's a bit pernickety.
Well, she's paying a loan back now, you know, and she asked, it was herself asked, you know, she said if she could get the exercises, if she could do the exercises. Yeah. They said if she could do the exercises, she could get home. And so they said that because she wasn't an overnight patient,
they half the money.
They only give her half that back. And I'll tell you, she was on to Sinn Féin and Piers Doherty and them all. But I think you do have to stay.
Yeah, but that being said, if she wasn't made fully aware of that, it might be possible. It might be possible to appeal that. I certainly would advise you or her to get in contact with the Ombudsman's office, Martin, because it's a chunk of money and she's going to be paying that back for quite some time now, obviously.
Oh, she is. I'll tell you, she can't sleep at night, Ella.
All right.
Thinking about it to tell you this, but
okay.
She's a...
Well, listen...
pensioner.
Yeah, I get you. We'll give Ger's office a call initially, okay? We'll Caroline will get back onto Ger's office and see if there's any scope for you to appeal that, right? Save you wasting the time.
Right.
And at least then maybe it might give her a bit of peace of mind to know one way or other. So will you leave that with us? And we have your number and we'll get back to you. I'm not sure there is, Martin. I'm not promising anything, but you know what I mean? Just on the off chance that that's something. Because she didn't know that by leaving that day, because she was mad to get home,
she didn't know that
she would... okay. Right, leave it with us.
That's all right, Greg. Thanks very much.
Best wishes to your mother, Martin. Thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed. Okay, 086 60 25,000 is the WhatsApp and text number, or give us a call on 07491 25,000. We have Minister for Further and Higher Education, Research and Innovation and Science, Minister Simon Harris, on the programme now. Good morning, Simon. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good morning, Greg. Thank you for having me on.
It's good to have you. Now, you are announcing funding for a project in East Donegal today. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I can indeed. I'm in Donegal today for three things, really. Firstly, I'm visiting. We are giving the go-ahead for a significant extension and expansion of facilities there in Stranorder for the College of Further Education and Training. Really conscious that they do great work there, but also very conscious that it is a school campus. And they've been looking for quite a period of time to have dedicated space for the post-leaving cert courses, so that you don't have, I suppose, a secondary school and a further education college having to double up on the facilities. So today we are announcing the green light for that, and the project will now move to design and planning. I'm also announcing today that we're topping up the capital funding available to Donegal ETB by €153,000. This will enable them to carry out other small projects across the county as they wish. And I'm particularly excited today to be, something we discussed on the programme the last time I was on, to be meeting some of our new nursing students in Letterkenny. These are students who have entered the nursing degree programme without any reference to their CAO. So it's a new way of doing your nursing degree. No matter what point you get in the Leaving Cert, you're able to now start your nursing degree in a College of Further Education in Letterkenny and then be guaranteed you can complete it in the Atlantic Technological University. Whereas up until now, a lot of nursing students doing the post-leaving cert course were finding themselves having to go to the UK to complete their degree, which was just nuts, quite frankly.
Yeah, I'm just on more general stuff while I speak to you, because it's great to have that positive news. I mean, obviously you'd be aware, and it's something we've covered in this programme before, that the capital spend per student in the Northwest is 25% less than the Irish average. That's over the last decade. Why is that, Minister, and what can be done to address that imbalance?
I think there's been a couple of reasons behind that. I mean, I think one has been a statement of fact that we haven't had up until now a university in the Northwest, and that has obviously changed now thanks to the incredible work of many people, but I think particularly of Paul Hannigan in what was Letterkenny IT and now ATU, the Atlantic Technological University. I think secondly, and your listeners will know this very, very well, but I've gotten to know it very well, I think the lack of education provision of scale in Derry has caused real challenges as well. And that's why we as an Irish government have very recently announced a multi-million euro investment to expand the Ulster University campus in McGee. I mean, John Hume and others have been marching, highlighting these issues back in the 60s and 70s about the lack of educational provision in Derry. So now, the direct answer to your question, what can we do? I think now that we have a university in Donegal, and now that we have a university in Derry that is expanding, the opportunities for partnerships and collaboration in the Northwest really are quite incredible. And I think we're at a very, very big moment here.
So when do you anticipate we might see that imbalance addressed?
Being truthful, I mean, I don't have a year in mind specifically, but I think there's absolutely no reason why we won't now see both ATU Donegal and the McGee campus coming forward with big and bold projects. And what I can say is, we have, separate and distinct to my own department's budget, we have what we call the Shared Island Fund in the Department of the Taoiseach, €1 billion in it over 10 years, and we're ready to start funding projects from there. So we're open. I suppose my message to education providers in the Northwest, and they know this, is that we're open for business in terms of trying to receive applications to do even more. Look, and there are other encouraging signs. I mean, I know from my time in the Department of Health, the synergies between between health on both sides of the border. We now are going to see medicine students in Derry from the southern jurisdiction, if you like, from next September. Mm. We're now doing nursing education on an all-island basis. We're about to develop all-island apprenticeships. This will benefit the whole island, but it'll disproportionately benefit for good Donegal.
Well, with that in mind, what supports will Donegal students have studying in Northern Ireland? Because, unless I'm mistaken, currently they don't have access to a SUSE grant. As I say, I could be wrong in relation to that.
You are wrong on that one, yeah.
Okay, sorry. Good. What is the status now in terms of if you're studying in Northern Ireland and access to a SUSE grant, Minister, please? Just so people know, I know.
No, I appreciate that. You're right. You can still access the student support if you study in Northern Ireland, as though if you study here, because of our common travel arrangements. But actually, the bigger issue, and the bigger issue, being very honest, Craig, is the level of mobility in general has slowed down a lot. One of the things I've written to all universities as recently as last week is to see what more we could do to encourage mobility between the two jurisdictions in terms of education. We have funded. You know, when Northern Ireland left the European Union, we decided now to step in, and we're providing funding from this September to make sure students in the north can continue to access Erasmus, as an example. So, I mean, we're parking kind of politics and emblems and constitutional questions here and just saying, what can we do to collaborate and cooperate in areas where it simply makes sense
and Minister, to drive on in relation to that? In relation to that, you would know there are deficits in certain areas. It's all across the country, but particularly here in Donegal with OTs, speech and language therapists and what have you. There are a number of Donegal people, and we've spoken to them over the last couple of months, that have studied in these areas in Northern Ireland, but they find the CORU process so long and so ridden with red tape that they don't engage with it. They want to work in Donegal, but they're having to work in Derry or elsewhere in Northern Ireland or Britain. 9 months wait, they can't afford not to be earning at that point. Do you recognise that as a problem, and what can be done to try and streamline that process?
It's a very real problem, and I'm acutely aware of it, and it's quite frustrating because we're working to expand the number of places in speech and language therapy and OT. So, for example, there'd be 50 students from the south studying OT, speech and language therapy, and other therapies in the north from this September. But a lot of them will say to me, well, hang on a second, we could do the degree here, and then we come out and we can meet registration challenges with CORU. There is now a group set up between my own department and the Department of Health on workforce planning. And I accept that CORU is independent. I accept it's the regulator. But I also think it's entirely appropriate that they at least engage and talk to education providers in relation to this. And that's what I expect next.
Because even in some disciplines, CORU expect a qualification above the qualification that's that is awarded in Northern Ireland to work in certain areas down here. You know, speciality in language, in particular with the speech and language therapists, that it doesn't make sense, and we're losing fantastic talent that want to work here in their own county, but simply can't. But it's good to see that that's being addressed. Can you give us any indication as to when that might be streamlined somewhat? Or, as you say, I know CORU are independent, but this is a crisis at the moment that we need addressing.
Yeah, look, they are entirely independent, but put it to you like this. We're now spending taxpayers' money ring-fencing places in the north for students from our jurisdiction. And it simply would be illogical that we're investing taxpayers' money and that those students would come out of that system and not be able to work in our own health service. Mm. So there's students starting right now, this month, and I think it's a legitimate expectation that they should have that they're able to work in the health service. There's a number of different ways you can address this. I mean, from an education point of view, closer alignment in terms of the criteria. But also, I think you are right, and I don't want to cut across regulation. I mean, the idea that somebody would study in the north where maybe the language requirement is different for obvious reasons, and yet would be a very fine speech and language therapist or OT, but then wouldn't be able to practice here. Mm. I mean, so there needs to be a little bit of give and take and common sense, I think, on both sides.
Okay.
Now, of course, the more we do things on an all-island basis, I think the more it's important the programs align as closely as possible, and that would help.
When is the ATU, because we have a 20% dropout rate here in the Northwest, which is incredibly high. That's attributed to some extent in terms of with accommodation and what have you and travel and access. But anyway, in terms of accommodation, when will the ATU up here be able to borrow money to build accommodation?
So the direct answer is I've given €1 million to the technological universities to come up with their plans for student accommodation. And they're doing that now. I expect the output of those plans in 2024, and I expect us to be able to press go on projects in 2024. Now, as your listeners will know, and let's not mislead anyone, planning permission, design, and et cetera, are obviously things we have to go through. But I expect to be able to move forward student accommodation projects for our technological universities next year. I would also say to people, though, and I accept that this is not ideal for everybody, but when you are in a housing crisis, I mean, there are as recently as Friday, 121 rooms to rent, digs, as they're probably commonly known, advertised on the ATU Donegal website.
Yeah, okay. And one other concern we hear from educators in this part of the world is the lack of professors sort of north of this Galway-Dublin line. Yeah. An awful lot doesn't travel north of that line, unfortunately. But just as it relates to professors, because that's sort of part of your ministry, what is the story there and what could be done to address that? Because obviously that has its implications as well.
Massively. So, I mean, the factual reality is only a few short years ago, Donegal didn't have a university. Donegal is now a university county. There is a university campus in Letterkenny that provides a huge opportunity. Step one was to establish the technological university. We've done that. Step two now is to negotiate what new contracts might look like. Not forcing anyone, by the way, to switch their contracts, but what new contracts might look like so those universities can really operate in the way everyone wants them to around research, professorships and the likes. And these are talks I expect to be kicking off in 2024. So the answer is we want to see professors in our universities. That has to take place as part of a landscape as to what is the contract for somebody working in a technological university versus one of the old institutes of technology. It's the next big piece of work. And it'll dominate a lot of 2024 from our perspective.
All right, budget just around the corner. Speculation today that you are going to implement measures that would remove the requirement for a person to be in full-time education to avail of grants, lone parents, single parents, and what have you. Is that on the cards? Is that going to happen?
Yes. Yeah, so let's dispense with all the usual cliches around that's a matter for the budget and just take that as read. I mean, what I feel very strongly on, Greg, is at the moment there are a number of barriers and poverty traps and anomalies in the student grant scheme. For example, if you could be a single mom or a single dad, you could be trying to raise your kids, hold down a job, pay your mortgage or pay your rent. You want to go back to education to get to where you want to get to in life. But the only way you can do it at the moment and get Susie is full time. That doesn't work for you and therefore you maybe don't go. Part-time education can be a really, really good way for someone to get to the exact same destination, but we need the student grant system to catch up with the 21st century. So it is something I'm working on, and the details obviously are a matter for budget day, but I genuinely believe if we're serious about tackling child poverty, child well-being, tackling intergenerational disadvantage and deprivation, this is one key way to go about it.
And very finally, just one typical example of people's engagement with Susie. Hi, Greg. My daughter studies at Queen's, and was declined a Susie grant as they were €51 over the threshold, even though I've not worked in over a year due to a triple heart bypass surgery. How is that encouraging students from Donegal to study in the north? So I can't ask you to obviously comment, Minister, directly to that point, but it's kind of typical of an awful lot of what we hear. Do you have have sympathy for that listener? Is there anything that can be done for someone in that situation? Or do we need to... there always is going to be a cut-off, I suppose, and people are always going to miss out. But when it's by such a narrow margin for someone who isn't working, it seems unfair.
Yeah, look, and two things I'd say. I mean, firstly, if you feel the outcome of your student grant application has been unfair, or you feel there are particular circumstances that should be taken into consideration around help and its impact on your livelihood, you can appeal, and you can also appeal to an independent student appeals board. So I'd certainly encourage any listener who has concerns in relation to that to consider that course of action. And look, the second thing, and you've been good enough to acknowledge, anytime there is an income threshold, obviously that does always mean there's people each side of the threshold. I would like to see progress on the income thresholds, because I'm conscious with both inflation and people's incomes rising, there's people who may qualify for SUSE 1 year and find that they're a few euro over the threshold this year. You don't want a scenario where someone gets a pay rise or, you know, works an extra shift or something and all of a sudden loses their grant. So again, these are matters for the budget, but both the fee level, and remember last year we were able to reduce college fees by 1,000 euro, that really helped people. Both the fee levels and the grant levels are things we are looking at actively now in advance of the budget.
Minister, thank you very much indeed. And as I say, people get a lot of criticism, I suppose you do when you're in big jobs, but in fairness, I think you've done really good work in terms of alternative pathways, apprenticeships and what have you, because that progress it needed doing for quite some time, and I think you've made good inroads in that regard. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much, Greg. Good morning.
Take care.
Thank
bye-bye. You very- That's Minister Simon Harris there, Minister for Further and Higher Education, Research, Innovation and Science. Interesting to get responses on the record to a number of those key issues, particularly as it relates to the ATU here in the Northwest and where it's going, and addressing some of those imbalances that have been here up until now. They're on the record then, and we can check progress. That's what it's all about, isn't it? All right, back with more after these. Damien Quinn, founder of Spear Neura, joins us on the programme now. Damien, good morning to you.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
Nice I am good. Dan, it's great to have you on the programme. Okay, talk to me about your organisation. And you've created this off the back of your life experience, Damien.
Yeah, so basically my organisation is called Spear Neura, Irish for New Horizon. And that is a journey through the criminal justice system onto a better life. So when I went to prison many years ago, I used the time constructively to reflect, to plan for a better future, to become job ready. And then when I got out, then it meant absolutely nothing, because I couldn't get work anywhere. I couldn't get a house, I couldn't volunteer, couldn't get into college. So all of that work and effort to change seemed pretty, pretty pointless. And to be honest, I ended up kind of going backwards along like many other people, I believe. Today, now the repeat offending rates are 61% after prison. And I firmly believe that that is linked to the inability to tap into opportunity. So what I've said
is that
today,
most the opportunity after one is released from prison. But can I ask, Damien, you know, some people think that people go into prison and come out worse people as a result. But prison is about punishment, of course, but rehabilitation, you know, I imagine that that is what the motivation is, so that people, you know, change their ways and become you know, contributing to society in a positive way. From your experience inside, is prison set up like that? Or do people perhaps who were petty criminals go into prison and come out perhaps even worse than when they went in?
I think a lot of people go to prison for very short sentences, and they're not there any length long enough to have any meaningful intervention. You know, they're taken out of whatever structure they might have had in place. They've lost all that then. They're to get out and reapply for all of that again. And it's so difficult when you got a background. So, but in the mainstream prisons, like, you know, it's the education and training is every bit as good as the education and training that's outside. And there is opportunities in there to use your time in a constructive way. I myself would have relied upon a lot of people in there for educational support. And when you read about them people today being dead or right back to where they started, you know, justice didn't prevail for them people or them families. So
yeah, and it's interesting, and I never really thought about it, Damien, that when you came out, presumably everything would be flagged on Garda vetting, and the Garda vetting's there for a reason, but it would limit greatly what you could do if you wanted to start contributing again to society. In terms of employment, Is it the employers were just a bit nervous employing someone with a criminal record? Or, like, talk to us a little bit more about those barriers that you referenced.
Yeah, well, like, I would have gone for many jobs when I got out. I went for houses and all that type of thing. But Garda vetting would come up and that would be the end of the road. In fact, it is pretty much used as a mechanism to filter out. Don't get me wrong, I'm not up here trying to... Like, criminality is wrong, like, and it has to be punished. That's never up for debate with me. I did what I did and I served my time and I took it firmly on the chin too, like, you know. But, like, when somebody recognises that they need to change, when somebody is doing everything that they possibly can to change, that needs to be captured and supported, because everybody wins when somebody turns their life around, you know.
How do you, through Spiranua, help others then? Because, I mean, you can't eliminate some of the blockades that we've been talking about. So what is the pathway?
So what we do is we work in a peer mentor, like I mentor other people. We have like a peer mentoring network across the country. What we do is we kind of explore and build portfolios of commitment to change. So we capture all of the evidence since the time somebody committed a crime, and we get it assessed and validated. And we bring it right up to date. So at this very moment in time, we can confirm with certainty that this person has done an awful lot of work on themselves and it has a value. What that is from us is a certificate of commitment to change using the model of recognition of prior learning. So we capture all of the steps out of a life people take. We look at their educational attainment, you know, the addiction issues that they've been resolving, you know, the positive change, what they've learned, what the reflection process as well, you know, how they're going to apply that going forward. And we bring people right up to date. We don't guarantee future behaviour because nobody can guarantee that. But what we can say with confidence is that this person is working really hard on themselves and they deserve a break.
Would this be useful as part of the sentencing process, or if it was recognised by the courts, do you think it might give it even more credibility, but do you know what I mean? More weight.
Well, it is like, so there's an integrated sentence management program, which is fairly new.
Okay.
We there's an ISM officer. So what you can do when you go to prison is you get inducted and you're told what you can do with your time. And then you can set a few goals with the ISM officer then. And if you see that through, that should leave the gate with you. That's what we're saying, you know. We are actually currently working with the Department of Justice. We've had meetings back and over, and they're currently writing their new criminal justice employment strategy. But the point is, like, you know, when you get a conviction, like, your good standing in the community is removed, but there is no mechanism in place that restores your good standing after you've been appropriately punished.
Yeah, but some of us, that's societal. Maybe we aren't forgiving enough. Maybe we aren't prepared to give people a second chance. And now with, obviously, the internet, if someone does commit a crime, it's there for eternity. I mean, people can, you know, try and get it taken down. And I've worked with people in the past who've tried to turn their lives around. And, I understand that. I understand that. But again, I just think sometimes someone's convicted and we, you know, scumbag this and all that kind of stuff. And sometimes it's deserved, don't get me wrong. But I just wonder if we as a society maybe need to be a little bit more open to giving people a second chance to turn their lives around.
Well, look, the reality is, like, there's about 2% of the entire prison population who are a danger to society and a danger to themselves, you know. But for the vast majority of people in prison, they are people that might have made some stupid mistakes, foolish mistakes, whatever. Nice people at the back of it all, but did what they had to do out of necessity to survive, you know. Them people are all family people. Them people do want to play meaningful parts in their family's lives. They do want to contribute. They do want to be somebody. They just need the chance to get going. And I suppose society in general, we can lock people up and throw away the key by all means, or we can lock people up in prison and treat them like animals by all means. But we will ultimately be letting animals back out onto the street if we did that. So really, if people want, like I used to hear it all the time, you think he'd cop on and get a job for himself. I've been trying, like I would have been trying at the time as well. Like, so if society want people to contribute and be productive members of society, then we really, really need to re-explore how we do the criminal conviction disclosure piece. So
Okay. People can get more information, I presume, Damien, by searching out Spira Nua. It's S-P-E, Father I-R-E-N-U-A, and get more information on the work that you're doing.
Yeah, and it's coming out now as well. The article on the whole background, the origins of the programme is being published in the Irish Probation Journal, which is out this month too.
Okay, brilliant stuff. Thank you very much for your time. I really do appreciate it, and hope things continue to go well for you, Damien.
Thank you, and thanks for having me on.
No, it's our pleasure. Take care of yourself. 086 60 25,000, WhatsApps and texts to that number, or give us a call on 0749125,000. We'll be back after the news and obituary notices. Please stay right where you are.